Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, new video was released that shows police intentionally corralling protesters before firing tear gas into the crowd during demonstrations on June 2nd. After much Sturm und Drang over the last year, the RNC comes and goes in a day, but not without protests breaking out. CMS works on reducing connectivity issues for online classes and on a plan to phase in a return to the classroom. Governor Cooper makes available COVID relief funds to help people avoid eviction and to help pay utilities. Bills, and in Charlotte, grants for small businesses reach over $12 million. And here to talk about those stories and more is David Borax from WFAE News. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Mike.
Mary C. Curtis is columnist for Roll Call and a contributor to WCCB-TV. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Mike.
Nick Oxner is sitting below you in my frame. He's WBTV's executive producer of investigations and their chief investigative reporter. Good morning, Nick. Welcome back.
Hello.
Hello. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor for the Charlotte Business Journal. Thanks for being here, Eric. Good to see you.
Good morning, Mike.
We're all on the radio. We're all on Facebook Live. What a tragedy that is this morning, at least for me. On June 2nd, as a protest blanketed the country following the death of George Floyd, CMPD used tear gas on protesters. We all know about this. We've talked about this a lot. And it was an incident that sparked considerable controversy and debate in the community and on city council. It picked up notoriety because of the Facebook Live feed by Queen City Nerve.
We're trapped here. We're trapped. They're shooting pepper balls at us. They've thrown out tear gas, flashbangs, smoke. They just chased everybody down this way. There's a line of riot police up there. There's a line of riot police back there. We're trapped here. They're up top shooting at us.
Protesters say they had been corralled into a one-block area from which there was no escape and then fired on by police with pepper spray and tear gas. City Council, if you all recall, ended up barring police from purchasing additional chemical agents during this fiscal year, and CMPD promised an investigation. They have been denying that what unfolded that night was an ambush, but on Wednesday, police video was released that catches a private conversation from one officer's body cam that tells a different story.
Rory's got a platoon on Tryon, out of sight. Dancer's platoon on stage now on College, out of sight. We're going to push their ass straight up 4th. As soon as they get up on 4th, because we got a bottleneck now, Rory's squad is going to step out and hammer their ass.
Other portions of that tape reveal police had at least two groups of officers in concealed positions ready to go. One would step out to block forward movement, the other to block a retreat. What has CMPD's new chief, Johnny Jennings, had to say about the emergence of this tape and what is on it? Who would like to take that question? Nick.
They gave a preview of the tape that they were about to release that day. And they talked about everything that they've done to this point to try and improve the situation, including adopting some new policies. They're not using tear gas these days. They also mentioned that the sergeant who was involved in this has been disciplined. He's a couple of weeks of, he's not able to get a promotion for a couple of years. He can't do training. He's been suspended and that sort of thing. So they tried to indicate up close that, before this thing came out, that they are taking steps to do something about it. But at the same time, CMPD is not really taking responsibility for this action, as far as I know.
Nick, did they release this tape voluntarily? I know you have to go to a judge to have these tapes released.
Well, that's right. No police chief in North Carolina can release any tape on their own. Let that boggle your mind again for a second. But this video was released upon a petition filed by CMPD. And that's commendable, quite frankly, because we've now seen the tape and it does not help CMPD's cause whatsoever. It's also worth noting, Mike, following up on your first question there, that the department has since changed several policy directives about the use of tear gas and the tactics that they must use with tear gas. But beyond the one sergeant who's been disciplined, nobody who like actually came up with the plan that Sergeant was describing in the tape you heard, nobody has been disciplined. And so far, everyone who's reviewed it, including the State Bureau of Investigation, has found that there were no actual things done wrong.
So,
well, you heard the chief say, his quote was something to the effect of, that is not something we want to repeat. But in the same breath or the next breath, he said that it is an acceptable tactic. And I think we've seen and heard that a lot with these incidents, which is the police department will say, we don't want to do it like this, but we didn't do anything wrong.
So, Nick, you just said that the person who was disciplined was not the person who strategized and planned this tactic. Was the person disciplined the person we heard on the tape talking to other officers about what was about to happen? Or do we know?
We don't know for sure. I believe it is that sergeant. There's a second line of tape that is equally troubling where an officer tells his fellow officers on bikes to throw flashbangs behind protesters to direct their running, and that running happened to be in the direction of the tear gas. Later, he then says, wave bye-bye, you're about to all get gassed. I mean, this is language that you would expect to hear maybe from soldiers on a battlefield, not amongst people who swore to protect and serve the people on the streets.
And Mary, as Nick said, this does not serve CMPD's cause terribly well, but it does speak to police attitudes around the nation that we have been seeing unfold before us piece by piece, incident by incident, because of body cam video and also bystander phone camera video. Talk about that for a second.
Yeah, exactly. This isn't happening in a vacuum. When you hear these kinds of quotes, and as Nick said, it's more like a battlefield, that police are not looking at these communities as the communities that they're protecting, but as the enemy combatant. And while the police leadership is always saying we're there to enforce the peace and keep the laws from being broken, scene after scene and video and audio, sometimes not from the police body cameras, but from citizens, well, they're showing a contradiction. And so this is only going to lead to mistrust. You saw recently, of course, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, where the police chief and sheriff seemed in their press conference to blame the people who were shot and killed, three were shot, two were killed, on their own deaths. He said, well, they were there after curfew. Well, so was a 17-year-old, the young man who has been charged with their killings. And video earlier in the night showed that police were giving the protesters water, and they were carrying weapons, and they were also out after curfew. And there was some audio of them saying, oh, we're happy to see you. Then after he was accused of shooting these two, when he was running down the street, people were saying, stop him, he shot somebody, and he just seems to walk by police cars. And so it does feed into the narrative, and then you will have more and more distrust that these police have picked a side.
Well, that incident on June 2nd and what we heard on that tape also plays into the political dialogue that we heard this week at the Republican National Convention, and the flip side of it, which I guess we heard the previous week. I don't think the charge by the president that Joe Biden wants to defund the police is an outright lie. Period. End of sentence. Full stop. That's a lie. But they do want to take different approaches to this. President Trump last night in his speech at the White House essentially said, we must support our police. And by that, he means let them do what they say they need to do to get things under control, because America is burning down under his watch.
Well, it is really interesting, because he is still running as this outsider protector when he is the incumbent. And Kellyanne Conway came out and said these scenes play in. They're good for us.
Yes.
And you've seen their definition of law and order, which is very narrow. It, as you said, Mike, is the police should have full reign. It is not, he did not mention the name of Jacob Blake or George Floyd or the people who, people are saying the police should have the law applied to them. And these counter protesters and Boogaloo boys coming with rifles should have the law. So it is a very narrow, as you said, Mike, definition of law and order. But it is only seeming to get more and more ratcheted up. And every time one of these police videos or audios come out that show, and you can hear them talking about protesters as though they are enemies, well, that's just only going to make it worse.
So there are 51 videos in the group of videos that were released as because CMPD asked a judge to release them, as you said, Nick, to their credit. Has anybody had a chance to watch any of that footage? And if so, what does it reveal?
Well, it's these videos.
David, if you're talking, we don't hear you. We don't hear you. We'll try to reconnect with
David.
It's these
videos that show the conversations that we've already talked about and that you just played, okay. Mike. It also, they released video from Snoopy, the helicopter, the CMPD helicopter. And that gives us a sense of kind of from an aerial perspective what happened, right? And when you watch the video from Snoopy in conjunction with the hearing the conversations about the plan, what they were going to do, everyone has pointed to the fact that, oh, well, the protesters did have a narrow pathway of escape, so there's nothing wrong here. You get the sense that that pathway of escape was really an accident. That was not intended by the police officers. They may have had it, but it was not on purpose. And there is a lot of video, and this is shedding a lot of information.
Okay.
I think the other thing that's interesting is we were talking about, Mary was talking about that national perspective. You know, you hone in on Charlotte, which is obviously dominated politically by Democrats. There has not been a great deal of reform. There's been a lot of talk. There's been a lot of controversy. There really hasn't been much change with policy. I mean, you even look at the tear gas purchase. Remember, they had already had tear gas stored, and they had spent $100,000 on chemical agents the year before. So not much has changed. And by the way, this week, a city
they
council
member
was pepper sprayed during a protest.
Nick, you pointed out that in the request to have these tapes released, they had to go to a judge. And that hearing, which should have been public, was not on any calendar anywhere. The only people who knew about it was the police and the judge. First of all, is that legal? And secondly, do you see it as part of a pattern?
Yes, definitely part of a pattern. We reported back in May about a hearing in a case that had public interest being heard, not on a calendar. In fact, in the case in May, the press explicitly asked to attend a virtual hearing and was told no, so shut out. And here we are again, where a judge heard a petition in a very highly publicized case, this one, and no one knew about it. It was not on any calendar. Maybe most troublingly, is our court leadership in Mecklenburg County says there is no requirement to publish a calendar to the public, and there is no requirement that the public know about a hearing before it is heard. That's, of course, implies that the public can access a court hearing they don't know about. There is a First Amendment and a common law right of access to all court proceedings in this country, and to including civil proceedings in the Fourth Circuit, which includes North Carolina, and you can't have access to something you don't know about. And so the way the court personnel and court leadership in Mecklenburg County would have it, you should put on a mask, you should come to the courthouse, and you should roam around the courthouse looking for hearings that you might want to sit in on.
Why is that their we have 20 seconds. Why is that their position, do you think?
I really don't know. It is contrary to the concept of transparency, and our courts are founded, a foundational principle of our legal system is that people have access to see how it operates.
Nick Oxner has another burr under his saddle, which I'm sure he will deal with over the coming months. He's with WBTV News. We're here with Mary C. Curtis, David Borax, and Eric Spanberg as well. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fifth Third Bank, dedicated to the financial empowerment of the community by investing time, resources, and people in the Charlotte area and throughout the state. More at 53.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. David Borax is with us from WFAE News. Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Nick Oxner, executive producer of investigative reports at WBTV. And Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, contributor to WCCB-TV. Although the 2020 Republican National Convention officially ended last night with Donald Trump's acceptance speech, the will-they-won't-they on-again-off-again relationship between Charlotte and the Republican National Convention reached a climax on Monday.
This convention will come to order!
The Charlotte Convention was on, but if you blinked, you probably missed it, because about 4 hours after the convention was gaveled in...
We are adjourned.
In between, they took a roll call vote, which was interrupted twice, I'm told, once by a speech from Vice President Mike Pence, later by a speech from the president. But somewhere in there, North Carolina GOP Chair Michael Whatley made the Republicans' choice official.
It is my honor and great pleasure to nominate Donald J. Trump for the office of President of the United States of America.
The delegates did not work on a party platform. There is no Republican Party platform. Instead, they voted their continued support for the president and left it at that. So, what else did they do for the several hours that they were in town?
I mean, there's really not much to say. They had the formal nomination. The vice president spoke. Of course, President Trump came in and made his quasi-surprise speech for about an hour. And as you said, it wrapped up pretty quickly. And then that was the RNC for Charlotte, North Carolina, 2020.
Woohoo!
I think it's really interesting that their platform, Mike, as you said, usually a lot of people don't pay attention to platforms, but they do state the party's missions and plans. And this really was an admission that the Republican Party is the party of Trump. And basically they're saying, whatever this guy thinks, no matter what norms are broken, this is what the Republican Party is about. So
the president's visit was billed as a surprise. And I'm wondering if it really was to anybody at that convention, because they had an extraordinary amount of security for 336 people around the Charlotte Convention Center. And even on last week, when they were talking about what streets would be closed and the fact that they closed down the Blue Line, and you had to take a bus connector to get to the other side of it. To me, that said, this wasn't for the delegates. This was for some major bigwigs at the behest of the Secret Service. Was this a surprise, his visit?
Well, and you remember, what was it, a couple weeks earlier when President Trump was in the Triangle, he had said he would be in North Carolina, and then they kind of went back and forth. It's kind of like the convention itself. It was on again, off again. But clearly, security has to know when they're moving the president around. So, yeah, I don't think it was a surprise to everyone. The striking thing, the obvious thing here is that you have a convention that, but for the protesters and the delegates, anyone else in Charlotte, you really didn't even know what was going on. You had no idea. There was no discussion, really. If you're a political junkie, yes, but for the broader populace, it was just, sort of a non-event.
And we already knew he was going to be in North Carolina because of that trip that he and Ivanka had planned for the other part of the state family food box program. So
part of,
people kind of made that assumption.
David.
It was part of the Trump administration really likes to keep us guessing. I think it's a game that he likes to play, and they did it really well this time. You had news outlets reporting he's coming, and then news outlets reporting he's not coming, and then at the last minute, of course, he showed up. So, it is a game with him. I think he likes being able to wave his arm and see how people jump.
Well, as is the custom, the president's new home state, Florida, was given the honor of putting the president over the top in the delegate count during the roll call, and then the president emerged and strode to the stage.
Now, if you want to really drive him crazy, you say 12 more years.
So the president's speech at that convention seemed impromptu. What did he say to the gathered delegates?
Well, my colleague Steve Harrison here at WFAE reported that he seemed to be mostly off script during the speech, and he talked about what's going to be one of the key themes over the rest of the campaign, which is that Democrats are trying to cheat. And he made lots of unsubstantiated claims about mail voting and fraud, which is something that, if we remember, in 2016, Republicans were accused of doing. So I think one of his themes will be to be talking about how the Democrats are going to be doing things like this.
Yeah, a recent report.
And from a local standpoint, he had that interesting defense of Mark Harris and the 9th Congressional District. That was I don't know that that was anticipated, but he certainly spoke up for Mark Harris, even as he was accusing, as you say, David, the Democrats of plotting to harvest ballots or engage in some sort of illegal mail-in balloting.
Well, a recent report released by the Republican-led Senate Intelligence Committee was damning in what it revealed about Russian cooperation with key Trump campaign aides in the last run-up to the last election, including Paul Manafort. Democrats have been concerned that this effort is continuing in some form or fashion, and some people, I mean, in the intelligence community have assured us that it is continuing in spades. Democrats are also concerned about the administration's efforts now to slow the mail down and to cast aspersions on mail-in voting as evidence that the president is trying to cheat to win this election. But at the convention center on Monday, as you said, the president accused Democrats of trying to cheat as he made more unsubstantiated claims about mail voting and fraud.
We have to be very, very careful, and you have to watch. Every one of you, you have to watch.
This is not normal behavior for an American president, and it's dangerous. Mary?
Well, yes, and a lot of people are saying that he's setting up this expectation so that if the vote is close, or if he doesn't win or all of this, that there will be doubts in the results of the election. It will sow doubts, and also there will be a lot of litigation. And no, it is not normal. As usual, North Carolina is a part of this because Louis DeJoy, the head of the Postmaster General, is a Trump donor that is now the head of it. And even though when he appeared before Congress recently, he said
on the same day, Mary, on the same day that the RNC is in Charlotte, he's in Congress talking about the Postal Service. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. You're right. And he seemed not to know a lot of things, and he denied what a lot of people are saying on the ground, which is the mail has been delayed. Yeah. But as I said, this is a president who had his big speech on the White House lawn, pretty much. And so he is going to sow doubt about what the results of the election.
So one of you mentioned
a lot of people who are Republicans, like they had a convention, a counter convention in Charlotte, I guess the convention on founding principles, which are Republicans who are against Trump. And that's what they object to more than his policies, the breaking of norms in a democracy.
Yeah.
They didn't get much play, but they were in Charlotte as well.
So one of you mentioned the Mark Harris incident. The president, while he was speaking, said he brought up the voter fraud issue in the eastern part of the state. It was Republican voter fraud. It was perpetrated on behalf of a Republican. And it was not mail-in ballot fraud necessarily, but it was election fraud. He said that Mark Harris, the original candidate, had been treated very unfairly, a phrase he likes to use when somebody is being accused of a crime and is actually being, the crime is being prosecuted. Harris himself called for a new election in that 9th district. Was it the 9th district? I think it was, yes.
Yes.
Situation.
Yes.
Mike,
do you
Mike,
think that, I'm sorry, what?
No, go ahead.
Do you think the president was aware of all the details of this situation in North Carolina?
His comments underscore the differing view that you might have of what happened in the 9th district between Republicans and Democrats. It is worth pointing out, though, Mike, there is a lot of evidence that in Bladen County, a Democrat-aligned group was doing and has done the exact same things that McRae Dallas, the operative who worked for Mark Harris, has been accused of doing as well, and there's evidence of that he did. The 9th district scandal has been blown out of proportion in terms of what happened, but has been misconstrued and twisted over the years. Again, for Republicans to say, look, this is terrible, there's a narrative that has gotten away from what actually happened in Bladen County in 2018. And the president's remarks this week were just another example of someone on the national stage talking about it in a way that is less than informed.
And so remember, you know, he's speaking to a national audience. He's not speaking to North Carolina in particular. How many people even know anything about the 9th district of North Carolina or care what the details are? And that's what he's counting on. That's what a politician counts on. Go ahead, Mary.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying Trump often accuses someone else of doing things that he may be doing. And so that is fitting into that pattern as well. As you said, Eric, he's going to say fraud, and people will say, oh, what did the Democrats do now?
So this convention was here, then it wasn't, then it was. And that's all because Governor Cooper refused, and Mandy Cohen, the state health director, said, if you bring it here, you have to socially distance and you have to wear masks and you can't be in that big arena, which is why they yanked it and brought it back with only 336 people. The GOP provided delegates to this convention with badges that facilitated contact tracing, should that be necessary. But Steve Scheffler, a delegate from Iowa, told WFAE Steve Harrison he thought the measures were a bit much.
I mean, I'll follow the rules because it's what we're here to do to get the president renominated and the vice president. But I don't like where this might be going down the road. Maybe mandatory masks today, maybe mandatory vaccines tomorrow.
But the Republican City Council member Ed Driggs, who was an alternate delegate, was on this program on Monday on Zoom from the convention center boasting about their COVID precautions.
This is a reflection of the difference in the attitudes of the parties towards how we respond to the pandemic and what kind of a shutdown we're prepared to tolerate. So the Republicans have always been more aggressive about trying to open the economy, wanting people to get back to their lives safely.
Yet later, TV coverage showed a distinct lack of social distancing at that convention here in Charlotte and a lot of folks not wearing masks. Is that how you reopen an economy more quickly, by ignoring health precautions?
Well, obviously not. I mean, if you're following scientific evidence, scientific recommendations. I think one of the interesting things here is that you heard from Gibby Harris, the Mecklenburg County Public Health Director, that she was contacting Republican officials because she was concerned. To date, Mecklenburg County has not released any results of testing or positive cases. They have said they will compile an after report and make that public at some point. But I'm not sure if Nick may have been part of this. Joe Bruno was part of it. There's a lot of push trying to get these results, and so far we just don't know.
Well, and there have been some reports, unconfirmed because we can't get the information, that there were people who tested positive when they came to Charlotte. That information is public. It exists on a document somewhere. That is public. You must produce it under the Public Records Act. Under the law, you can redact things and give the public part. There's no HIPAA violation, no privacy violation, releasing a number of people who tested positive here. And yet the county has refused to do it. They've now acknowledged that they first cited HIPAA, or implied HIPAA, and have now acknowledged that HIPAA does not apply here. And now they said they're choosing to wait until they release the after action report. And Mike, if I may reveal my second burr today under my saddle, the government agency does not have the option to choose when they release public information. It is not up to them. The county, for some reason, is choosing to hide the number of cases of COVID-19 that came to the Republican convention. It is dangerous when health officials are not transparent. There's a whole CDC manual about how important transparency is to managing a pandemic. And here we have the exact opposite.
And Nick, there's a bit, the other problem that this points out, illustrates very clearly, is no matter how severe or not the restrictions are, if you can't enforce them, what good are they?
Were they in violation of any agreements that they signed in advance of coming here?
They said clearly that they were going to be masked at all times during this convention indoors unless the social distancing was enough, which clearly it wasn't. I mean, the people were sitting close together at tables. They're moving around without masks. I mean, this, as you said, this was on TV and in pictures. It's not like we're guessing at this. It was visually documented.
So finally, about the Republican convention in Charlotte, it was as truncated as it was. Protests actually started 3 days prior to the start of the convention. That's the march on Monday, the fourth day of the convention from Marshall Park to South End. It was marked by some disturbances. What happened?
I was out there on Monday night, and it was bigger than the other days had been. As you mentioned, they started on Friday when the Republican National Committee came to town. They gathered at Marshall Park at like 8:30, 9 o'clock, and they started marching. The marchers seemed to be very organized. At the beginning, they were handing out masks and face shields to everybody, and of course, that's good for preventing COVID. The face shields are also good for preventing if you get pepper sprayed, and since there had been pepper spray used
in some of the previous nights, that just made sense, I guess, if you were a marcher out in front there. There were, you know, a couple of tense situations. In fact, all during the day, there had been other folks around uptown, and there had been a couple of arrests. But during the march, they went into the South End for a brief time, and as they were coming back, they were on Carson Boulevard, and somebody pulled down a flag from one of the businesses there and started burning it in the street. And the police on bicycles came in, and there's disagreement about what happened. The police say that an officer was trying to get in to put out the fire. The protesters say that the police charged the line and knocked people down. They did make an arrest there. That was the kind of highest point of tension. But there were other spots where the police blocked the way for protesters to get back towards the main part of uptown, and they were face to face for a while and yelling at each other. And, you know, you could see the police officers behind the line with their fingers on the spray bottle of the pepper spray. And, you know, it wasn't a good situation, but it did not escalate into tear gas or anything like we've seen in other protests. In fact, I believe that CMPD has not used tear gas since that June 2nd incident we were talking about earlier. But, you know, the point of the protest was really to show resistance to the fact that the RNC was here and the Trump administration's policies. And, you know, I think we may see more of these as other incidents arise.
Originally, 50,000 people were supposed to be here, only 336, maybe a few more when you count some of the behind-the-scenes personnel, Eric. What if any, financial impact to the benefit of Charlotte did we derive from this convention?
Well, I think two anecdotes will illustrate. One is Pierre Bader, an owner of a couple of restaurants in Uptown, when I asked him what the impact was, he said, quote, "What happened is zero." The other thing that really is telling is that the spokesperson for the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority told me that they would not be doing an economic impact study because there simply is not enough activity to warrant one. So that tells you the difference between what was expected, $200 million, and what they got.
When we come back, we'll talk about CMS working for a plan to return to the classroom and also plans to expand their Wi-Fi influence for students who are having trouble getting online. We'll get a COVID update and much more. And then we'll also have one more thing to talk about with regard to our political atmosphere right now when we come back with David Borax, Mary C. Curtis, Nick Oxner, and Eric Spanberg at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with David Borax from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV, Eric Spanberg, Charlotte Business Journal, and Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, contributor to WCCB-TV. Before we move on, Mary, there was something you talked about, I think it was this week, on WCCB-TV, and that has to do with the fact that every election cycle in recent years, both parties always characterize the potential election of the other party's candidate as the end of the world as we know it. This Chicken Little syndrome is in full regalia this time around, and people on both sides really believe that if one side or the other wins, it is the end of our democracy. It is the end of the republic.
Yes.
Is this hyperbole?
It is an America that you would not recognize.
Is this
hyperbole?
That's
where they stop, because for Democrats, they see the breaking of norms that Donald Trump has pushed the limits, and they really ran on character and competence, that this is someone who does not empathize Donald Trump. They were attacking him, and that he is just not up to the job of handling a pandemic that is still killing 1,000+ Americans a day, the economic upheaval with millions on unemployment, and the racial reckoning that they feel he is putting salt in these wounds in America. Now, for Republicans, their attacks on Joe Biden have not really stuck. So you see them calling him a Trojan horse, that he is going to be this vessel for radical socialists that will come in. And you saw they had the couple from St. Louis that brandished guns on marchers from Black Lives Matter. They were featured speakers. You had Representative Matt Gaetz saying that they wanted to empty the prisons and put MS-13 gang members next door to you. So it was a really doom and gloom scenario But, you know, he has been the incumbent. So you had Mike Pence, the vice president, said he wants to make America great again. But at the same time, they're trying to posit Donald Trump as being a kinder, gentler president. So you could get whiplash as he is swearing in at a naturalization ceremony, people from countries that he's formerly called expletives, and using the power of the presidency. And so I think it's going to get darker, because you could see from his speech that he likes to lean into this American carnage image. It was interesting. They had more minorities on the stage than they do in the administration. And so expect to see more of this division. And the fear is that at the end, no matter how it turns out, that the other party will say, well, if America is over, then we've got to fight it.
Well, let's move on that happy note. The first several days of school were marred by technical issues here and around the state, and it played into the beginning of this week, too. CMS Superintendent Ernest Winston was on the program this week, and he told us that the district is trying to roll with the punches as tech issues pop up. But as you can hear, even he was having technical issues on this program.
We do understand that this is and can be frustrating for many families. And I certainly know that we empathize as parents, too.
I think he said, we do understand that this is horribly frustrating for... I had to listen to this a lot yesterday. We do understand that this is horribly frustrating for many families, and I certainly know that we empathize as parents, too. I think that's what he said. And there is deep concern about the digital divide, legitimate concern, and how it might be interfering with education for a lot of students who are already facing challenges. So CMS has been working on addressing Wi-Fi issues. What are they doing?
Well, this week they went live with 7 Wi-Fi hotspots. They are in school buses. They take the school buses, park them outside of 5 schools, and in another 2 cases in centralized locations where the need is particularly acute. And then the students come and they don't go on the bus, but they are near the bus and they get the reliable internet service. And I think maybe it was Andos Helms with WFAE that reported there are 16,000 students, I think, that need more stable internet access. And that's roughly, I think, 10% of the district. So this is a serious problem.
Yeah.
Think about what that means. You know, you're talking about, what if you had to do your job? You had to go drive your car somewhere and set up your laptop and do it. I mean, you know, I guess you could go to a coffee shop, but it's really not the same thing as working out of your house.
Actually, no, you can't go to a coffee shop because they've taken out all the seating. CMS is also involved in planning phased-in return for in-person classes. David, do you know what that plan might be?
That's right. So they've had this committee, this metrics advisory committee, talking to them about what it would take to get back to in-person classes, and they say, obviously, that's our goal. But the superintendent has said that any model will involve phasing things in, and he's talking about younger kids and those with special needs being the first ones to return. There's been lots of rumors about what date this might happen, but the superintendent at this point says we don't have a date for that. So that's how it's going to work.
At least one CMS student who was identified by WSOC-TV as Musa J, I don't know if I'm saying his name correctly, said they had mixed feelings about any phased-in return.
I'm a bit concerned about the fact that it could be a bit too early to open up schools, but also, at the same time, I don't like doing online school like that.
So when they phase this back in, and they eventually will, what metrics will they be using? Will they be using Mecklenburg County health statistics, the state's health statistics, CDC health recommendations? What will they be using?
You know, they're going to be using the same data that we're hearing from everybody. The CMS has put out a note saying that about 28 employees have been reported since August 8 to have COVID, and so that's one number that we have. They admit that when school comes back, you know, teachers and students are going to have COVID as well. And we're already seeing this at universities and colleges. So it's something that we know is coming. And I think the other thing, the second meeting of that committee that I just mentioned was yesterday, and they raised concerns about things like air quality and filtering that they're doing. And they're clearly there's a lot of things that need to happen before CMS can open, both to be confident itself and to instill confidence in parents and teachers.
Speaking of COVID, we have an update from the RNC here. Mecklenburg County now says that two RNC attendees and two support staff have tested positive for COVID. It'll be interesting to see what comes out of last night's event on the lawn at the White House. The county says they've been told to isolate, and anyone known to have contact with them has also been notified, I guess, through those badges that they were asked to wear. So where are we right now with COVID? Well, I know Mecklenburg's numbers have been declining as of Sunday. An average of 6.4 of those tested in Mecklenburg County were positive. They'd like that number to be, I think, at 5% or below, but it does represent a decline over the last 14 days. Is that because the rate of infection is declining or because our number of tests is declining?
You know, it's probably both of those, Mike. Mandy Cohen, the state health secretary, said in a press conference this week that the number of people being tested is going down, and she cited several factors for that. Some part of it is the summer vacations, people aren't around. Part of it is that, you know, many people are feeling like we're farther along and they don't need to be tested. They're urging people to continue to get tested, especially if they've been in group situations and to, you know, folks who've gone back to colleges, universities or schools, that sort of thing. But, you know, the number of tests is going down. I also think, though, it's true that, I mean, if you look at all the numbers kind of in a big picture way, our curve has gone up to what looks like a peak, and it is coming down the other side. So it may be both of those.
The Mecklenburg County website says, quote, based on publicly available mobility tracking data, social distancing slightly increased and then slightly decreased in Mecklenburg County over the last 14 days, representing a fairly stable trend, end quote. Where do they get this publicly available mobility tracking data? Where does that come from?
From your mobile phone, Mike.
Okay.
You know, depending on what kind of services you use, they can keep track of that. It's done anonymously, but they can put all that together and aggregate it and see what people are doing.
So a lot is riding on the numbers trending down, but the state apparently is going in the opposite and the wrong direction. UNC Charlotte, which has gone virtual, may bring students back to class October the 1st if conditions are right. But other colleges and universities are having significant problems. We all know about UNC Chapel Hill's about face on telling students to come and then telling them to go home. Yesterday, North Carolina State University students were told to leave their dorms and go home. Both of those decisions were the result of students not following social distancing practices, partying, etc. Now State Health Director Dr. Mandy Cohen says college campuses should be doing more to hold students responsible for activities. And Dr. Sharon Gaber, the new chancellor of UNC Charlotte, was on the program yesterday, and I asked how they plan to enforce students taking health precautions on their campus when and if they return to classes in October.
We have the Niner Pledge. Students are making a pledge when they are able to come back that they will uphold all of the standards and expectations. Also, we have within our code of student responsibility that they will be held responsible for wearing a mask in a classroom inside buildings, that they won't be in large gatherings. We will have the opportunity to work through that code of responsibility to remove individuals from our campus community as needed.
Of course, COVID continues to keep businesses closed. Hardships are rising, but North Carolina announced this week that it will use $175 million in federal coronavirus relief to help with housing costs. That means what? Rent and utility relief? What else, David?
Exactly, Mike. The governor several weeks ago, when he announced that the state was going to relax the restrictions on evictions and that sort of thing, promised that there would be some relief coming. This money all comes from Federal CARES Act and other federal sources. It's being divided up into several different programs. So some of it will go for rent and utility support through community agencies. Some will be done through government agencies. And the Department of Health and Human Services itself has another $53 million to help with getting people out of homelessness or at risk of homelessness. So all of these are an effort by the state, again, using federal money to try and deal with this issue.
And Eric, you reported this week that Charlotte Small Business Grants Program awarded a combined $4.6 million to 372 local companies, at least $17.4 million for additional grants. Where is this money going, and is it too late for businesses to apply?
Businesses, the deadline, they've extended the deadline a couple of times, and now you can apply up through this Sunday. So if you're interested, you go to either United Way of Central Carolinas or Foundation for the Carolinas websites, and you can learn what you need to do. This, again, Mike, picking up on what David was saying, this is coming from Federal CARES Act money, and they are hoping to have all of this distributed by mid-October.
And it isn't just colleges that are having these COVID outbreaks. It's happening in our prisons. Nick, you reported this week that prison officials in Morganton have traced a spike in cases to inmates who work in a laundry facility. Was this a work release program?
So it's different than work release because prisons have actually suspended all work release programs, and yet these inmates are still going to work at the Broughton Laundry. Prison officials have now confirmed that they sent these workers there. There were three cases at the laundry. They continued sending the workers there. Four inmates got infected. That's now led to the prison being on what they call red status because of the number of COVID cases. And they've continued sending workers to this laundry and to work in the kitchen. This is just the latest thing that we've heard in how the prisons are handling COVID-19. There's a hearing today in Raleigh where the ACLU is going to ask a judge to rule that the prisons are not following a judge's order to improve the way it protects prisoners from the coronavirus.
In the midst of all of this, Governor Cooper released his 2020-2021 budget proposal, which includes plans on how to spend the remaining $900 million in federal coronavirus relief funds. What are some of the proposals in the governor's budget? Anybody?
You know,
David.
Yep. He says, you know, more critical than ever to get this aid out there. His discussion in this was about getting more benefits for people. You know, he spent a lot of time in that discussing the need to expand Medicaid as well. That goes beyond the $900 million in COVID aid, but I think he spent a lot of time on that. And that's an issue that, remember, held up the budget the last time, and he vetoed it, and the Republicans were not able to override that veto. So we're going to see another big fight on this coming ahead.
He's also encouraging increasing...
He's
also encouraging increasing unemployment, and in an unusual move, Phil Berger, the Senate leader, a Republican, is on the same side on this issue.
Yeah, generally speaking, the Berger and the Senate Republicans have indicated they agree that unemployment benefits should be expanded right now. It remains to be seen if the House will go along with that plan, but this is something it appears there might be some consensus on in Raleigh, and that's a sentence that we say a handful of times a year.
Governors
and
also...
Go ahead, please. No, yeah, I was just going to say it's worth noting that in North Carolina, the benefits are 12 weeks, so some of the shortest in the nation, and $350 maximum per week, again, on the lower end of the scale. So that's what's driving a lot of this conversation.
The governor's budget is always a wish list, and it has to go through the legislature. And as long as the legislature is controlled by Republicans and the governor is Democrat, a lot of that stuff in the budget doesn't get passed. But he's talking about bonuses at different levels for teachers, kindergarten through college. He's proposing a $988 million health infrastructure bond. He's proposing $4.3 billion bond to invest $2 billion in school construction alone. We are in the midst of an economic collapse, Eric. Is there money for this?
Well, I think the bigger question goes back to what Nick was talking about, which is when you look at the statement from the GOP lawmakers as soon as this was unveiled, it was almost an instant no. They didn't like anything about it. So I think it's highly unlikely to move forward.
There is some money hanging out there because the state collected more than it expected. The debate is going to be between Republicans who want to save that for a rainy day and the governor who wants to spend it now.
You get the last word, Nick Oxner, and I'm sure you're very happy about that. Nick Oxner from WBTV, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and WCCB-TV, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and David Borax from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.